Mark Dernberger here in Minneapolis with an interesting conversation with a most extraordinary man, guitarist Les Paul. Actually, I guess guitarist is what most people remember you as.
Yeah.
But you were actually a lot more than a guitarist. You were a guitarist, inventor,
yeah,
raconteur, pirate broadcaster, and I think sound recording genius. You started in radio a long time ago. Do you remember your first show, your first job in radio?
Well, the first one was for Crazy Water Crystals. And that was a kind of a gimmick type of where you take these crystals and you put them in your water so that you get your correct amount of minerals and so forth and so on. Well, I'd packaged those crystals in Milwaukee, and I got my first job. That was my second job. That was on WISN, the Crazy Crystals. The first job was WHAD, Marquette University, where Tom Snyder came from also. There I got my teeth fixed.
Uh-huh, trade out.
It's a dental school.
You're right.
And university. And it was there that I played on WHAD and got my, and for two songs I got my teeth cleaned and fixed and whatever. And the interesting thing about it was is that the engineer was sitting on the floor with a crystal set with a cat's whisker, and he got the station in good with his earphones. He pointed to me. I sat on a bed, and the mic was there. It was a double carbon button, carbon mic, and did my two numbers, and that was the first one. Then Crazy Water Crystals was my first commercial show, but I had to go down to the factory, down to the plant down there, and pack boxes, and then go over. And my third job was where I broadcast on the air, and then I went downstairs in this department store and sold radios.
Wow.
So I was a salesman selling radios.
This was in Wisconsin.
Yeah. That was Kenosha, Racine, Milwaukee. And then when I left home the first summer, I played Appleton and with a cowboy band. And I remember the bass was too loud, so they put the bass player out in the hallway. The clarinet player was too loud, so they opened the window, and he played out the window. Streetcars going by. And then the next one was in Iron Mountain, Michigan, and we went down an alley, and there was, you know how the feed stores are in the alley where you come up with your wagon and toss your hay off and so forth. Well, I go in this little barn about the size of this room, and a fella had his crystal set sitting on the floor again with his legs crossed and getting it tweaking to get the station in nice and clear. And we went on the air with the band, and a guy come over and whispered in my ear to look out the go out the back door, and there's no steps, you know, you have to crawl into this loft like. And I looked out there, and he says, look down to your left. And I looked down there, and I saw some smoke. They asked me to look for the smoke.
Smoke.
And it was the barber.
The barber.
And if we were coming in good, he took some hair out and put it in the street and lit it. And I says, we're coming in good. Coming in good. I got a good signal from the barber. And he went back cutting his hair, and they enjoyed listening to the station. It was 50 watts. Now, these are some stories you're liable not to hear. We were burning.
Didn't I hear somewhere that you were, at 17 years old, you were making some exorbitant amount of money at a radio station in New York?
Yeah. I made more money in Chicago. I was on WBBM, WGN, WCFL, WAAF, and NBC. And CBS. I'm sorry, CBS was the main station. I don't know why I thought of that last, but I came there in 1931, and we made, my partner and I, Sonny Joe, and I was Rhubarb Red, the two of us, we made $1,000 a piece just on CBS alone. That's not counting the Laughing Lady on GN, that's not counting all the other shows, over the Labor, WCFL, and then NBC was every Friday night from the Bismarck Hotel.
Boy, that kind of money must have been beyond your wildest dreams.
Well, when I left there, making $1,000, I had so many shows and so much money, And I didn't know there was a depression on or anything else. When I left, I remember my bank account was $90. I spent it all. A punk kid making all this money. And I ended up sleeping above a tavern on the north side. I had the pleasure of dropping to $5 a week.
But even that was a lot of money back then, wasn't it? Well, you weren't hurting for a long time, I don't think. And I know you were interested in being a jazz musician. Didn't you get picked up by another station?
Yeah, I got a call to go down to KMWX in St. Louis. And that was quite an experience for me because my mother got on the bus, Greyhound bus, and took me down to St. Louis and dumped me off at the station. We cried, and then she turned around, came right back on a bus. And I went into KMOX and everything, and my first night was a Saturday night. And they said, your hair isn't red enough. And so they got some henna, and they dyed my head a real carrot red, you know, a real good job. And they were putting me on, but I didn't know it, so I went along and henned my hair and everything, and I was getting all excited because Saturday night I'm going to be one of the new, a new group on the roster there with all the other great talent down in St. Louis. And someone talked me into the idea to write some fan letters.
To yourself.
And so that I would draw some mail to myself, yeah. And so three or four guys, we all sat down and wrote letters how good I was and so forth and so on. And when Saturday come around, they canceled the show. So one day, this mail comes pouring in. They come into the radio station addressed to Red Hot Red, Rhubarb Red, you know, and I wasn't even on the air. So you talk about getting caught with your pants down. That was a fast opening.
But they did put you to work.
Yeah. For Phillips 66 Gasoline, I did my first date with the orchestra. And so they put the music in front of me, and I looked at it. I didn't know what a diminished chord was. And so when the band was rehearsing, the producer, her name was Margot Clark, and she came, she was a redhead. And she came out because there was a problem. And she stood over me, and she says, the problem, she said to the engineer, is right here. And so she says, play that part. And I played that part, and I went from a G to an A. And when it comes to the diminished, C diminished, I played real soft. I thought diminished meant the coolant. They asked me why I did it, and I told them why, and the band cracked up and everything, and I got redder and redder.
Now, this is, well, you were pretty much just a kid, but, you know, you're growing up in this little town in Wisconsin, and you're tinkering.
I'm sure tinkering.
And this is where this interview could go in six different directions, and I would love to talk to you about sound recording and what you did there, but maybe we'll do that on another interview. Let's go down the road of the fun you had in radio and some of the toys that you built and used. When did you start playing with radio toys?
Immediately, I was on a paper route, and we used to supplement the papers. And I noticed the kid next to me, he was finished. He put the green sheet in the Milwaukee Journal so fast. And I said, what in the world are you doing, Harry? And he had a toilet roll there, just the cardboard center, and he's winding wire on it. I said, what are you doing? And he got this 24 wire, never forget it. And he's winding a coil for a crystal set. What in the world is a crystal set? Well, you can pick up stations with it and everything else. Well, man, I was hooked. So here I am, and to outdo him, I had an oatmeal box, and I was winding my mine on the oatmeal box and then stomped down on a tin can and bent it into a slider fader, and at least I could select the stations on this little job. And went over on the railroad track and picked up some pieces of coal that came from the iron up in Minnesota up there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And found some that would detect the WTMJ, but not too loud. And so I would pump my bike out there with my headset and the whole thing and sit under the towers. and listen to it. But I could hear the fellow move with the strings, the clock tick on the wall, and this, it just hooked me. And so I just begged and begged until my dad gave me his radio. And when I got the radio, this is a battery set, so I had a battery charger and the A and the B battery and the whole thing. And from that, I found that detector stage, and I wanted to get in there with a microphone.
The story I hear is that that interest led you into building your own closed-circuit radio station.
Closed-circuit job, yeah.
Yeah, why don't you tell us about the Booger Brothers?
The Booger Brothers, my guitar player, Chet Atkins' half-brother, Jimmy Atkins, knocked on my door and, "Let's get up," and I don't get up till noon, you know. I'm one of those up all night and sleep late guys. And so Jimmy Atkins is knocking on the door and he says, I got something you gotta hear. And he had a wireless phonograph. Okay. So the phonograph, he put the needle down and there's no wires on it, it's coming through the radio. Now this is 1936-37. And I'm looking at this thing and no wires. I says, "Well, then you got a transmitter in there." He says, "I don't know what's in there, Les." But he says, "Whatever it is, you don't have to hook any wires up. It comes, you just dial on the radio and you hear your records." And I says, "Hey, man, you know, where'd you get that?" He says, "I got it at Allied Radio out in Jamaica." Well, believe me, I was in that car in a minute. And I zoom out to Jamaica and I buy one. Mm-hmm. Now I got a little transmitter. But I have no intention of sitting there playing records with it. So obviously I picked up a mic at the same time and I have microphones and I got my PA amp. And the PA amp that I got from Lafayette or Allied was perfect for me because it had like four channels in and there's no EQ or just a tone control circuit on the master. Mm-hmm. But it did have on the back taps so that you could get 2 ohms, 4 ohms, 8 ohms, 16 ohms, and 70 volt line, whatever. And this proved to be perfect for me because when I fed the output of the power amplifier, preamplifier that I had, I could talk into it, play records into it and everything, and then it just switch the transformer setting in the back until it married the best to the transmitter. And then it told you, you know, put 8 inches or 2 feet of wire on it, and that, otherwise it's illegal. Well, nobody should ever tell me that, because immediately I get a roll of wire from here to Kingdom Come, and I it got softer. And as I lengthened the wire, it got longer again. And I says, "Now what in the world is happening here? It gets softer, then it gets twice as loud, and then it gets softer again." And so a guy says, "Well, if you get a neon bulb, you know," and he says, "if you double the length of it, and you know what you saw," I kept clipping and wiring it back on. It was bell wire. And I started going out the window, up to the roof, until finally the whole building could hear me on this little oscillator.
Wow.
So this oscillator, if you put enough antenna on it and a real good ground, you're doing pretty good. Well, I got on the air. We started sawing up boards down in the basement, and the manager of the building says, "You can have the basement." And it's got all furniture in it with davenports in it and all the furniture that's extra or burned or used, whatever. And the basement's ours. And we practice down there anyway. And Hitler is busy sinking ships, and we're building an illegal radio station. And so Ernie Newton, my bass player, and myself, we get this thing up and running, and we're on the air with it, and there's a fellow living in the building that's the chief engineer of CBS, and his wife gave him an ultimatum that either he quits playing with his damn toys or she's going to leave. So he finally made the decision, "Okay, gal, you win." And so he's quit quit at the CBS station as chief engineer, left the equipment, and said to the doorman, "Pat, tell that kid down in the basement that's playing with that stuff down there." And he says, "Tell that kid to go up to my room. Here's the keys, and he can have it." And I go up, and he's got a 1,000-watt hand rig, and he's got turntables, he's got everything that you dream of, and he's got books on electronics. So now I can read, and I can know what this means and what impedance means, and, you know, up until then it's impedience. I didn't have anything straight at that time. But we were on the air with it, and so I asked a friend of mine around the corner, electronic engineer, if he wanted this stuff, and he says, "Well, I'd give anything for it." I says, "Well, will you build me a transmitter on AM? You know, and I'd like something that will just cover a part of Long Island." And so he lays about a 100-watt transmitter on me, and he took the 1,000-watt rig, and he made me up a small package there and everything else, and a little mixer desk and the whole bit, and he had it all tied in right, and he drew out the schematic, the drawings for it, and everything. Well, now, that thing would cover the whole island. Now, that thing, we just pick a good spot on the dial, and we come in real good. The only thing is he didn't build a wave trap, and so the second harmonic also was on the dial. Well, I'm going dung, 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 but on the broadcast, when I'd pick up somewhere or down near what would be 570, I'd pick that spot. Well, then it would show up down on or up on the band in the 1600 somewhere. It would double itself, and it would appear there. I can't count at the moment, but anyway. So I had the pink and yellow network instead of the red and blue network. I had the pink and yellow network. Now I don't know who thought up the Booger Brothers, but I guess like everything else, I just hang a name on everything. So I call it the Booger Brothers Broadcasting System. And like when Roosevelt would give a speech, we called him Fearless Frank, the Ferocious Philosopher, with his fireside chat. And a minute before it's airtime for the president, why, we'd take the radio and dial it. You'd hear us going around looking for a good, strong station and set it up for the president. And then when the president's done, and if we didn't, we did a commentary on what Roosevelt said. So afterwards, we had two guys, two clunkers that didn't know anything, and we'd bring them in there off the street and ask them what they thought of the president's speech. And we broadcast every Wednesday night from 8 o'clock at night until 8 in the morning.
Did you have a stock opening for the show? Do you remember how it went?
Yeah, I had some gongs set up. They were real bad. Everything was put on. It was strictly camp. The whole thing, was a mess. And nothing ever went on time, but we had great jam sessions. We had two studios. They rehearsed in one. We had two commercials. One was the pizza parlor, which was the first in America, to my knowledge. You talk about having a first. We found the guy out in Long Island that had the first pizza place. And this was very exciting because we couldn't understand nobody knowing what a pizza was.
Now, your career as a broadcaster on the Pink and Yellow Network was cut very short, wasn't it?
Yeah, very short.
Do you care to tell us what happened?
Well, I must be accident-prone or somebody else is, and I happen to be where he is. But it seems to me that I was always doing something foolish, or they were doing something foolish, and I was involved. In this particular case, there was a coil in the transmitter, and I was going to pull it out. And I had the guitar on my neck, and I had my hand on the guitar, and I reached in the transmitter, grabbed the coil, and pulled the rack over on top of me. And at first, Ernie thought he was outside of the window in the studio, in the lobby there, down in the basement, our lobby. And he saw the rack go down and everything, and then he realized I wasn't kidding. And through the master switch, which was the light switch, like when you come in the house, you've got a switch right there, that was it. That threw everything on, threw everything off. I think we used bell wire for all the wiring down there, too. But the accident, they put me in ice. Ambulance came and took me to the Queens Hospital. And then I ended up at the Mayo Clinic up your way, and they told me to rest, and it was the same as being struck by lightning. They taped me up. It goes across your chest. It's a terrible feeling to have that current going through you. You can't open your hands, and you can't breathe. So you're paralyzed, and you got this shock going through you, and you can't speak, you can't do anything. I don't recommend it.
I guess. Guitarist, inventor, and pirate broadcaster Les Paul. And I hope we can continue this interview on After Dark at another time. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This is Mark Dernberger in Minneapolis.